Stay tuned for The Lynn Show. Today, I'm airing an interview I did with actor, poet, entrepreneur, collector, all-around Renaissance man, Alan Brasington. Alan is performing his theater piece, A Poem of My Life, at the Starlight Restaurant, Bar, and Performance Space in Sarasota, Florida. Alan is a unique individual with a rather unusual path to arriving at the places that he arrived in his life. Stay tuned for a very interesting ride. Hang on. Here come the show.
Hearing from an inner voice, finding choice where there's no choice, with gentle prodding from the voice. Oh, you really can. Deeper, deeper down from nowhere, sitting in my own soft lap, with all the time for us to chat, and my resources all on tap. Oh,
and welcome to The Lynn Show. The Lynn Show is about being the person you really are. As a psychotherapist, it's clear to me that many too many of us are living out a version of who we are. In my book, called When You Can, You Will, Why You Can't Always Do What You Want to Do and What to Do About It, I call this living out a cover story. It's the truth about who we are, but it's not the whole truth. In fact, it seems clear to me that early in life, many too many of us are forced to hide parts of ourselves. And I think of this as putting these parts of ourselves undercover. Because although we pretend not to have them, and finally actually forget that we have them, we have not actually lost them. And so the intention of The Lynn Show is to say that if you think this happened to you, if you think there are parts of yourself for which you are either in denial or you feel that there are things about you which you can't quite bring into being, that it may not be too late to recover what you may have had to hide. In my show, I interview people who make their living or their life with an art. I do this because when you listen to them, you can hear what it sounds like to be who you really are. And The interview I'm airing today with Alan Brasington is a perfect example of that. Alan is a man who when things he was not anticipating, not pursuing, arrived, came to him, became possible, he was simply able to say yes, to allow himself to become the person he really is by being open to those things which came into his path. I don't want to say too much more about the story because it's quite interesting and Alan tells it better than I could. So now, here is Alan Brasington. So I'm here with Alan Brasington, and I'm explaining to Alan that I interview people who make their living or their life within art. Now, I know that you're about to do and have done a theater piece called The Poem of My Life. And so, are you a performer? Are you an actor?
Well, I was an actor for 35 years, and first I was a school teacher, and I loved teaching, but I wanted something more. So I was fortunate enough to get a scholarship to the Royal Academy of Dramatic Art.
Okay, hold on. I want to get there. If you spent, did you say 35 years?
Yeah.
As an actor, then I'm going to talk to you as though the art to which you gave a big chunk of your life was acting.
Mm-hmm.
Do you remember the very first time that acting or performance or being looked at or telling stories or any of that drew you, became attractive to you, called you, seemed interesting?
Well, when I was a child, when I was three, I remember my grandmother told a dirty joke, which I never understood, and I'm not going to tell you what it is now. But
you know what it is.
Oh yeah, of course. And I.
Who did she tell it to?
She told it to my mother and her brothers. My grandma at that time was probably 35 or so. My mother, when I was born, my mother was 16. So my immediate family was pretty much
young.
And when I was born, I had three grandfathers and four grandmothers because my great-grandfather was alive and my two great-grandmothers were alive. And, but anyway, my grandma Myrtle told this story to her children, and I, of course, remembered all of it and repeated it to the neighbors, and every time I did, they would laugh. And I made my own understanding of the joke, but then, of course, when I grew up and went back to the joke, I realized, you know, the smuttiness of it. But it was.
But you knew it was funny because you saw how your mother and uncles reacted.
Well, the neighbors they laughed and they would say, "Alan, tell us that story again." And so I would tell it, and they would, of course, then invite other friends, people who were visiting, and they'd say, "Oh, Alan has a story to tell."
So for them, I imagine, it's not only that the joke was funny, but that you were telling it, that you were a little boy.
That's correct.
Right.
Because it's not a particularly funny joke.
No.
But it just has a little smutty ending, and so, you know, people do love to hear children say dirty things.
Especially when it's so innocent.
Yeah.
I mean, for you, it was innocent,
yeah.
Right? Yeah,
mm-hmm.
Yeah, okay, great. So, are you saying that that experience gave you the idea that there was something really nice about getting a reaction from people?
It was nice to have attention.
Yes.
And, of course, my mother, being so young, always knew all the stories of movie stars at the time, which she had written down in her diaries, which I could read, and she would talk about, you know, what Shirley Temple was doing and what Greta Garbo had done and, you know, all of those things. And I sometimes think that I'm living kind of 30 years behind my age, because I love black and white movies, and I learned black and white movies from my mom, who took me to movies. But then, of course, when we got our first television set in 1951, everything was black and white.
Yes. So wait. Do you think that your mother had, I don't want to say aspirations, but would have liked to have...
Oh, she should have been. She should have been an actress. She should have been the performer, not myself.
Uh-huh.
And I sometimes think also that I did what she wanted to do.
I don't think that that's that unusual, actually.
Mm. Yeah.
I think that happens a lot when there's a frustrated parent. A parent you love, mm-hmm. who, you know, couldn't do something.
Right.
Right.
Well, of course, it was such a different time when she was growing up. And she was, this piece that I've written has a great deal about my mother in it. It's really about my mother.
I really want to see the genesis of this acting thing. So you're 3 or 4 years old and you're telling jokes, and your mother is in love with the movies and acting and actors and is, I don't know whether she actually ever told you that she would like to have been an actor, or you just know.
Well, what makes me a good actor is the fact that very often I understand what people are saying without them telling me. So I would sit with my mother very often, you know, at the kitchen table, and we'd have a cup of tea and maybe not talk for an hour and a half. And I knew everything about her. I knew what she was feeling. I knew where her heart was. And I can't tell you enough that she was adorable. Besides being adorable, she was beautiful, and she had a kind of mad Irish sense of humor, and she just was very special.
How many years are between you and the next child that was born?
11.
11,
12, and 14.
11. So you know that, psychologically speaking, you're considered an only child.
I was an only child.
Yeah, and well, if there are 8 years between you, everybody is considered an only child. Mm-hmm. But 11 years, I mean, really, you were it.
Yeah.
And so you had mommy to yourself,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yeah.
And young as she was, I imagine she bonded pretty seriously with you.
Absolutely.
Right.
Yeah.
And that was that she was sending, I don't know how to say this, that you... I'm guessing, this is a guess, you know, that you learned to read other people because your mother was so important to you, and because she wanted you to know her. She was communicating with you. She wasn't trying to hide from you. Do you think that's true?
Yeah, but I don't know that she necessarily planned anything. It's just like, you know, if you sit in a tub of Jell-O, you know what Jell-O is, and you feel it, and
yes.
you're there. And you know, when I would be with my mom, that's funny, I never call her mom, but when I was with my mother, I was with her.
Yes.
I mean, we were. It was as if we were one person.
Yes.
You know,
yeah.
And it was quite extraordinary.
I think actually it is extraordinary. I think it is not common, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so. Now we have these sources, right? We have this bond that you had with your mother, which taught you, convinced you, allowed you to read other people,
to be with
them, mm-hmm. right? To have that as a way of being in the world, right?
Absolutely.
And then we have the joke, and these people who kept saying, "Oh, Alan, tell us a joke." Mm-hmm. So we had the attention. I mean, these are really things that could contribute to someone wanting to be an actor or being comfortable being an actor.
What you're saying is exactly what I understand, and that is, it's not what people tell you, it's what they don't tell you.
Ah.
And so with my family, so much, as with the people who were enjoying the joke that I told but not telling me why,
mm-hmm.
it was, you know, you live with people and they don't tell you they don't tell you a lot of things.
Yes.
They don't tell you the truth.
Right.
And that's something that you have to, that I've discovered, that I have to go back and discern the truth from what I remember. And I have gone back in my life, much of my life, to certain points in my life that are not, that are blockages. You have these blocks in your life. And you go back, and I've had to go back and kind of open them up. And so that, a lot of that, a lot of what I say in my piece, I hate people who say this about, you know, read my book, but it's...
no, come to the show!
Yeah, but a lot of what I say in this piece has to do with what has unlocked in my life.
Ah, that's great. Okay, so... So we have here, actually, a life that could very naturally turn a person into an actor. Did you have any experiences in before you decided to, you know, at 30 or whatever, to become an actor? Did you have any experiences in your early life that had to do with performing or acting?
Not really. I mean, you know, we made soldier hats out of construction paper and put them on our heads, and then the teacher would, you know, dab a little rouge on our faces, and then we would march out on the stage and sing some song that had, you know, nothing to do with anything. And I remember seeing a play in which my best friend was a carrot, and his line was, "I am a carrot, I have vitamin K." And that was, you know, but I never, I in many ways, you know, growing up with black and white, the people who were in black and white were pretty much iconic. So one never thought of Cary Grant or Greta Garbo or any of the really great people during the late 30s or early 40s. You could never think of them with their clothes off or going to the toilet.
Right.
They were kings and queens, truly kings and queens.
So another thing you might be saying is, so one might not think I could do that.
Right, exactly. That's exactly what I'm saying.
Mm-hmm.
And so, and one of the lines in my piece is that I came back to Broadway and I worked with people I'd only seen in black and white and that they were different in color. And so it's,
yes.
And
mm-hmm.
that is the true, I mean, now we're seeing people in color. I'm not so sure I want to see all those colors. I really loved films when I didn't have to see daily progress, daily things.
Yeah, no.
And I think art really is extraordinary. It should be extraordinary, or for me it should be extraordinary. And, you know, I think back to the Romans and the Greeks who did lots of hysterical things, but their theater came out of religious, you know, religion was theater.
Right.
And for me, religion, theater has always been kind of religious. And
I'm thinking magical.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So, okay, so although we have the training of an actor, we don't have an actor early on, although I have to say, it's interesting to me that you remember the construction hats and you remember the friend who was a carrot. So these things must have stood out for you.
Well, I remember my entire childhood.
Okay, never mind. I was going to say, no. In case you, unless you remember your entire childhood. Okay, so you weren't thinking, I'm going to be an actor.
No.
No. So you didn't try out for plays, you didn't do any of that.
No, no, I was really pretty, I kept to myself pretty much.
Yes, and sort of introverted, perhaps?
Yeah, yes, uh-huh.
Okay, so but so at some point you decided to be a teacher.
I grew up, what they sometimes say on television, I grew up poor. I was poor.
Oh,
we didn't have a lot of money. My my father, of course, being so young, and my mother being so young, I remember he was delivering milk for $16 a week, which was not a lot of money even in those days.
Yeah, right.
I was told by my guidance counselor that poor people don't go to college, and that I had to find something else to do. And I credit this to my mother, who was such a positive force. By not pushing and not being a positive force, she just was positive. Told me without telling me that I could be whatever I wanted to be.
Yeah.
And so I ended up going to college, and when I got finished with college, the only thing open to me was teaching. I taught in Monticello, New York. It was an extraordinary place. It was a big city village.
What year are we talking here?
Born in 1940. I graduated from high school in 1958. There were 76 people in my graduating class, and I'm in touch with probably 30 of them. I'm in touch with a great many people from my childhood and from my past life, and there's something about that. I mean, I traveled with my partner to 79 countries and all over the world, and I have friends all over the world. There's something in me that wants to be a part of people.
Yeah, you know, there is a term for that. It's Greek, actually. It's storgic. People who hold on to, I mean, because everybody doesn't have that, you know.
Yeah.
So you're a storgic person. I am too, actually, although not nearly as storgic as you. I think that's a range.
Yes, I'm at the extreme end.
I think you are, right. Okay, so you teach, and you teach for how long?
I taught for 2 years.
Okay.
And while I was acting, I taught at Syracuse University.
Well, wait a second. I want to understand how you suddenly decided to apply to the Royal...
That's all in
the
my
play.
Piece.
Okay.
All of it.
Well, can you say a little bit about what happened to you? What was the internal process that...
It wasn't any internal. It was all external. It was all... Things came to me. And I did say this, actually, after the performance, that things came to me, and I think I progressed in my life, because when something opened to me, I took it.
Yes.
And so if the gold ring came, I grabbed hold of it and went with it. I didn't know where I was going, but I knew that someone was offering me something, and it was something that was going to change my life. I wasn't going to be Poe no mo. And I was going to follow that to wherever it took me. And then when I got there, I didn't know what I was doing, but then I would go to the next place.
Yes.
So another thing that I've done, and you tell me if I'm jumping too much, but when I was on Broadway, the beginning of Broadway, and making not a lot of money, not enough money to live, besides teaching during the day, I also someone had said, there are people in Pennsylvania who are extraordinary workers, and they create a great many objects. So I would drive to Pennsylvania and buy antique things and bring them back to New York and sell them before my checks bounced.
Oh my God.
And so I began buying antique vintage clothing for movies, and I sold them to this extraordinary woman who had the largest collection of antique clothes in the world, and she had pieces from all of the American presidents' wives and from all the kings and queens. I've actually handled Queen Victoria's underpants, and I've handled Queen Marie Antoinette's coronation gown, which was tiny and was hand-embroidered with carnations, which was her favorite flower.
Oh my gosh.
And Helen Larson was the name of this woman. And I did all of the clothes for Mommy Dearest, all of the antique clothes, many of the scenes with the clothes that I provided were cut out. So there's only one real gown that's quite extraordinary, and it's the one when Faye Dunaway walks down the stairs. And that gown belonged to Elizabeth Arden, and I bought it in Arizona. This woman had a collection of clothing, and when I saw them, I said, "Oh, this is amazing, you know, can I buy them?" And she said yes, and there was a newspaper clipping with the clothes, and Elizabeth Arden had donated them to her maid. And so these were clothes from Caloser and, you know, many of the wonderful designers from the 30s.
Well, the other thing that occurs to me is, here yet again, somebody says to you, there's somebody in Pennsylvania making things, and you say, oh, okay, I'll go do that. Uh-huh. And that opens up an entirely new aspect of your life. You don't know when you're going to Pennsylvania to look at this stuff that this is going to become a big part of your life. It's another one of those that it shows up, I say yes.
Uh-huh.
Right?
Yeah. Right? Right, right.
Kind of a hallmark,
mm-hmm,
of your life, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's so much, you know, I see people who immediately say no to things.
And I
suppose it's fear. I don't know. I mean, I'm as fearful as anybody else, or was. I'm not so fearful anymore now that I'm old. But I think that our fear very often keeps us from doing what we want.
Well, I agree, but I think that one learns to be afraid very early on, and your mother told you in no uncertain terms you could do whatever you,
mm-hmm,
whatever came up. She told you not to be afraid,
mm-hmm,
and you believed her.
Yeah.
That's what I think.
That's absolutely right.
You know, and everybody doesn't have that.
No, well, and again, something else I tell other people is that we're so used to having people tell us what not to do. They don't tell us what to do. They tell us what not to do.
Yeah.
Teachers and, you know, older people, and we think that they're older than we are, so we should believe them. But we forget that they were told the same stuff that we were told.
Well, okay, so you didn't say, and I'm assuming it's a big part of the performance, that you didn't say what it was that got handed to you, that you grabbed, that took you on the road to make acting.
Oh, I do.
You do what?
Tell.
Oh, I'm sure you do.
Oh.
What I said was, I'm assuming that you didn't say it here because you say it in the...
Correct.
Right,
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Oh, I see. Yeah,
yeah, right. Yeah. So, of course, I am dying to know, and if you want to know, you have to show up for the performance. I don't want you to say anything you don't want to say.
Oh, no, that's all right.
Okay,
I don't mind.
Okay, yeah. Good. So, you went, did you say the Royal Academy?
Yeah, in London.
In London, right?
Mm-hmm.
And what a huge change in your life. I mean, my God, you were in Monticello and now you're in,
mm-hmm,
London.
Yeah.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
Right? The way you're saying it is that I wasn't thinking of being an actor, but something happened and I got this offer and so I said yes.
Mm-hmm.
So you went and I'm making this assumption, I don't think this is a big leap, that you really liked it, that you liked acting.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, right?
I used to watch old movies all the time. My mother would let me stay home from school to watch movies that I liked especially, or that she liked especially. And so, you know, then she would write me a note saying, you know, Alan was ill or whatever, she said.
That's right.
And I would spend, it was a time in New York when there were three channels, and the Dumont channel, which was channel 5, it was channel 9, showed the Million Dollar Movie, and it was the same movie for 24 hours. Every 3 hours, they would show the same film.
Where did you grow up?
Monticello.
Oh, you grew up in Monticello?
I did, yeah. And so I would learn the lines, and if it was Fred Astaire, I'd learn the songs and the steps and the...
Oh, my God. And you never thought...
Well, when you're very close to someone, as I was close to my mother, her brain was actually my brain, too. So I'm sure that I just picked up things from her. I mean, she was, her emotion was
right out there.
Right there.
Right. So are you saying you picked up her desire or her frustration?
Oh, I don't think she had any frustration.
She didn't.
She was
all right that she wasn't an actor.
Yes. She had no guilt, no sadness, no... I mean, sadness if someone died.
Yeah, no, I understand, but no regret.
No.
Amazing.
No, which is what made her all the more remarkable.
Of course, you know? Of course. Oh, so you really took to this like a duck to water, right? I mean, you were waiting all your life for this shot.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah, you said, yes!
Yeah.
Home at last.
Right.
Right?
Right. Yes.
Okay.
And when I got to London and I got to see... theater in England, and when I actually met a great many people at RADA, at the Royal Academy, who came to talk to us, to, you know, Sir John Gielgud and Dame Edith Evans and Laurence Olivier, and all of those people came, and they just talked, or they were there. And you saw the extraordinary, ordinary people.
Yeah, they were human beings.
Yeah.
They weren't icons and kings and queens. They were people.
Well, they certainly were. I mean, they certainly...
No, I know, but I didn't mean that.
I know what you
mean.
They
weren't untouchable.
Yeah. No.
Yeah.
And it was extraordinary to me. And so they opened doors for me that were extraordinary.
Right. I'm guessing that you were finally in an environment where you could explore all of who you are.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Right.
Yeah. Okay, so you graduate and you come back to New York and you don't immediately get on Broadway.
No. My acting tutor at RADA was named Mary Duff, and she was an extraordinary person who was the acting tutor for Albert Finney and Peter O'Toole. And Dorothy Tutin and, you know, Rosemary Harris. As a matter of fact, she had Rosemary Harris's Emmy Award on her old TV, and she said to me, Rosemary sent me that because she said it belonged to me, not to her. And that was truly, she was so extraordinary. So, and I wanted to work at the APA Repertory Company in New York at the Lyceum Theater. And I auditioned for them, and they didn't take me, but they said, we're going to be auditioning again in May. This was in March. And so I was offered some other jobs, and I decided not to do it because I wanted to be at the APA. And so I waited until May, and I auditioned, and I got in. Mm-hmm. And so I then worked at the APA on Broadway for a year with Helen Hayes and Nancy Walker. And,
oh, my gosh.
You know, lots of wonderful people, extraordinary people. And And then I got into a piece by John Osborne called A Patriot for Me. Mm-hmm. And then I went from there to the original Jesus Christ Superstar. Oh my God, I am so old now. And I worked, you know, on Broadway, and then someone said, I did a musical with Bonnie Franklin. Do you know who that
is? I do.
And Bonnie said, you have to come, I'm doing a show, you have to come out to Hollywood, and because that's where the money is. Of course, there wasn't a lot of money to be made in New York at that time. So I went out to Hollywood for a year. It's not my favorite place.
It's so much color.
Yes, yes, exactly. And I stayed as long as I possibly could. And then someone offered me a job, and I fell down weeping into my carpet and left and have never gone back. I think now, you know, it would have been easier for me to, if I could have withstood it with being an Easterner, to live in Hollywood, because I'm still getting checks for things I did in the 1970s. And
yeah. And special payments.
Yeah.
I know.
And, but, you know, we do what we have to do.
Yes. And it's, you said it again, you know, I mean, they handed you this thing and you said yes, and you went, mm-hmm. right? And that made all the difference.
Oh, yes. Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay, so you're a working actor, essentially.
I was,
yeah. You were a working actor. Mm-hmm. So why did you stop? When did you stop? How did you get here?
I was doing a show on Broadway called Two Shakespearean Actors. And it was about the Scottish play. You know, we're not
yes.
allowed to say the name.
Yes, yes.
In acting parlance, anyway. And
or you'll fall down.
Yes.
Right.
You'll suddenly sizzle, yes.
Right.
But and I came whirling out in my kilt, and I thought, I'm not really enjoying this anymore. I don't want to do this anymore.
Wow.
So I stopped. And I had reached a point with my prop business. We had done 1,200 old Chevy trucks for the Gap. We put a Chevy truck, a real one, into every Old Navy store in this country and Puerto Rico and Iran and some.
There are Old Navy stores in Iran.
Uh huh.
Oh my God.
And. And in the Philippines, and so...
So you were a businessman, in addition.
Yeah, yeah. And so, I've just been working on this last year on a few films that are American films that are being done in England now, because we don't keep costume shops the way that we used to, or prop shops.
Really?
And so... But the English do, and everything is right there. And they still don't have their collections of American things, and they also don't have the history that I know of old American stuff that I've been collecting for years and years. Not for myself, but for others. And so they call and say, you know, Alan, we need or for Dark Shadows, when they were doing Dark Shadows, he said, Alan, we need some traffic lights. And how often do the traffic lights change? And, you know, there's things
yeah.
like that. And I just finished the new Meryl Streep film about Florence Foster Jenkins. And I did Captain America, which is in all
right.
cinemas now. And, you know, I don't do a lot of props, because they get as much as they can, but when they get down to the nitty-gritty and they can't find something, or they don't know what was in a hotel in 1921,
yeah,
blah,
right,
blah, blah,
right.
And they call and ask me, and I send them photographs of what the possibilities are, things like that.
Yeah, it's great.
So, And we built an airplane, you know, a Wright Brothers airplane, here for Ralph Lauren that they that flew over one of his, you know, design places.
Oh my
last
God.
Year. And so I.
So you have a very full life, and you're still doing a passion.
Yes. Well, I'm kind of slowing down that passion, and I'm now doing more writing, and I need to allow what the people who have meant so much to me through the years. I mean, the show that I've written is about the people who say you can do it.
Yes.
You know, teachers and relatives, and you know, who reach out their hand to you without wanting or expecting anything in return, but just reaching out their hand, and that have given me so much. And so it's very emotional for me, but I have had the most extraordinary life, and it's not all my own. It's not what I've built. It's what has come to me, and what I've accepted. So I don't want it to sound as if it's an ego-based thing. It's not that at all.
I like to say you're never going to be someone who didn't have your history.
Oh, no.
And one's history, I think, sets one up to see something when it's being offered and be able to say yes to it or not,
mm-hmm.
right? And so clearly, you came out of that childhood open, right?
Mm-hmm.
Willing. So when people offered you things, you thought that was right.
Uh-huh, yeah.
You know, that was right, and you ran for it.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just lovely. So how did you wind up in Sarasota?
Well, I'll tell you that in a second, but I'm not locked in my history. I find a lot of people are locked in their history, and that kind of leads me into what I'm going to tell you, and that is, but first, a friend of mine from college called me a couple of weeks ago, and she lost her husband 5 years ago, and she's still where she was 5 years ago.
Yes.
I came down, I had no desire to come to Florida, but my partner, an Episcopal priest, dying of pancreatic cancer, wanted to come here. And at the last minute, we left the church and, you know, got all of our things in vehicles and drove down here. And the week after we moved here, he died.
Oh, my.
And so I knew one person, my brother-in-law, who is the weatherman on ABC, Steve Newman, and a friend of Steve Newman's mother. And I called up a friend from California, and I said, I'm here in Sarasota, and I don't know what to do, because I'm living in a big house, and staring at the walls, and I don't know where to be, what to do. I was in great mourning. And he said that his cousin, Alex Sink, had run to be the governor of Florida, and he would call her. And he called her, and she put me in touch with some people, and I started reaching out and meeting people. Ann Morrison and I were supposed to do a Broadway show together 40 years ago, and I got a different Broadway show, and I think she did do the show eventually, but she was doing something else, and so we never worked together, but we know so many people in common that Then when she said she was going to do this, start this Sarasolo festival, I thought, okay, I'll do whatever I can to help, which I did last year. And then this year I said, I've written something and I'd like you to hear it, and if you think it's right, I will do it for the festival. And someone has asked me to do Act Two, so I'm working on that.
Wow.
as the second half of this first half.
It's lovely. And again, it's interesting. Every time I have talked about this, and actually every time you have talked about this aspect of somebody offers me something and I take it, it has always seemed positive, exciting, upbeat, something, right? But here we have the same thing. This was his wish. It didn't look like a good thing. You know, you went with it because it came up in your life and you went with it and that's what you do. But it didn't look like the Royal Academy.
No.
You know?
But when someone is dying, if you love them, there is no choice.
Oh, no, absolutely. Yeah. But you would
I know
been,
you know that.
I do know that. I do know that. But you go for it, whatever it is,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yeah.
Even if it winds up that you're in a place and you don't know why you're there or
mm-hmm.
what you're supposed to do, right? But even that turns out to be what it's supposed to be.
Yeah.
Right.
And my partner, Alan, his church is still in the Bronx, New York, in the worst part of the Bronx, and for a great many years, 8 years, we lived at the rectory, and it's an all Caribbean church, and we redid the church. It had a great change while we were there. And I said to Alan when he got sick, why don't you begin a prayer meeting on the phone with members of the church? So they would call in every day and they would do prayers lasting about 15 to 20 minutes. I am now doing it every morning at 8:30.
Oh my.
And I'm not a priest. I'm not a particularly religious person, but I am a spiritual person. And so in the morning, these people call in, and I was on the New York State Council on the Arts. I have someone from the New York State Council who calls in every morning, and her aunt calls in every morning, and people from California and from Florida, and you know, the rest of the people from...
Now, they call in all at the same... they call on...
They call one number.
Right. Everybody calls same number at the same time.
Right. And we have a little talk at the beginning about, you know, how are things in Florida, how are things in... I have an opera singer who sometimes calls from Turkey, how are things in Turkey? And then we do the prayers and we pray for... people who are ill. We pray for Alan, even though he's no longer alive, and we are. It's just a loving thing.
Yeah.
So how long this will last, I have no idea.
But you have no idea how long any of it was going to last.
No.
And
no.
You didn't have to, and you don't have to now.
No.
Right.
No.
Right.
No.
Because if this is meant to end and something else is meant to start, you'll know it when it comes.
Uh-huh.
Right?
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Okay, I have another question. You have had, as you describe, an unusual and an extraordinary life. Would you say something about what that's like, how you feel about it?
Well, I feel emotional about it.
Yes.
I feel emotional about it every day, that this poor little boy from a tiny town. I actually lived in the woods. I didn't even live near the town. Without any expectation, I have had an extraordinary life.
Yes.
And it's a loving life. People have given me so much love and joy. And you know, you get that on the stage, but when the play is over, you go home.
Yes.
And the love is no longer there. You know, you take home what you take from the performance. But my having been given such love in my life, I don't know where it came from. I mean, it came from humanity, came from living and from good people. And, you know, I'm not saying there aren't any good or aren't any bad people out there. There are difficulties in the world. I didn't tell you that I was once a spy for Chock Full of Nuts. I had some of the most horrible jobs to do while I was trying to be an actor, while I was, you know, when I had no money and things like that. But good things came out of everything that I did. And so you asked me a question. I'm not sure I answered it, but I think I can't feel sorry for myself.
Like your mother.
Yeah.
No regrets.
No. She never felt sorry for herself. And she never made anybody else feel sorry for her. Or, you know, it just... I am now, my mother died at 57. I am now so much older than she was. And yet she lives through in me, and she lives in my brothers. You know, it's very, very much like, you know, biblical things where people are saying, you know, the Lord is living in them. I don't want to be proselytizing because I don't know enough about it. But I just know that goodness lives in us if we allow it to happen. You know, if we let it. So that's what I would say about it.
And that's a wonderful place to stop. Thank you so much, Alan. Mm. Because Alan was fortunate enough to have from his mother the sense that he could do anything, the belief in the positive, the possible, he lived a life which could not have been anticipated for a child born into the world he was born into. It's what he says, of course, a poor boy living in the woods outside of a small town in upstate New York, whose father was making $16 a week delivering milk. He became one of those people who he would watch and believe were icons, were kings and queens, were not real somehow. And I believe, and I think that he does too, I think actually it's clear that this was possible because he believed in possibilities. He didn't say, no, I can't have that, or I can't do that, or that's not for me. He said, okay, let me see about that. Let me try that. Let me go for that. And when he found something that really worked for him, when he got into the Royal Academy and began to behave as an actor, he knew he was home. He knew that he was what he was meant to be. The same thing when he began collecting. He knew this was for him. So it's my hope that when you listen to someone like Alan, you're asking yourself, have things come in my path which I was tempted to pursue, which I would have liked to do, which I even dreamed of doing, but I was too afraid. And I did not believe I could have or be any of those things. As I said in the beginning, The Lynn Show is trying to make the point it may not be too late. And if you'd like to talk about how one recovers what one may have lost,
You can find me at my website, that is thelynshow.com, thelynneshow. Don't leave the E out of Lynn, thelynshow.com. There's an email tag up there that you can click on and leave me any message. I will be happy to get back to you. You can get a copy of my book. You can even listen to me reading a chapter, the first chapter of my book. You can listen to all the shows I've ever done. You can even get me to come and speak to your group or organization. And for now, as always, I hope you got something from this show that you can use. Something that will make you want to come to the starlight and listen to the poem of Alan's life. But something that will bring you back, because I will be back next week, same time, same station. And as always, I sure hope you will be too.
You see, I'm getting older. My hair is turning gray. Oh, you say my face and figure have both seen better days. Well, I won't be retiring. I won't slip out of sight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Life's a song I keep on singing, not a tune that I once sang. I just keep returning like some goddamn boomerang. No, I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. You see that I have had my shot. My time has come and gone. Oh, won't I please get off the stage, let someone else get on. Well, I won't be relegated or leave without a fight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Life's a bell I keep on ringing, not a chime that I once rang. You may think it's unseemly. Well, I don't give a dang. No, I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Rising from the ashes every chance I get. I may be running out of time, but it ain't over yet. 'Cause me and Sister Phoenix, we won't give up the flight. No, no, we will not go gentle into that good night. And I won't go with a whimper. I'm going with a bang. Life's a song I keep on singing, not a tune that I once sang. I may not be as juicy, hell, but I still got some tang. So you won't hear me simper. I may have gotten